You're listening to the Rogues Radio Podcast, your home for creator interviews, comic book reviews, industry news and commentary, and the Retro Retrospective Movie Review Show. Welcome you to this episode of the Rogues Radio Podcast. My name is Dave Beatty, and I'm one of your hosts. For, it seems like forever, I've been a professional illustrator and graphic designer, worked on a lot of fun stuff, some really popular characters, things like, you know, Batman and the X-Men, Legion of Superheroes, which oddly is becoming relevant right now with the new series that's getting ready to roll out from DC. But enough about that. I want to welcome back my co-host. This is Mr. Eric Alexander. Please, Eric, tell the folks a little bit about you and what you've done as a creative professional.
Thank you, Dave. I guess I am the associate producer of a feature film called Occupants, which features Star Trek Voyager actor Robert Picardo. That film is currently available on Tubi for free. And I also was the publisher and editor of the comic book tie-in for Occupants.
It is time yet again for another movie and TV news roundup segment where we talk about things that are happening in the world of TV and movie news and all that kind of fun stuff. Tell me, Eric, what kind of fun things have you heard is going on in the world of TV and movie news?
Well, unfortunately, I have to start out with some not so fun things because in our time between episodes, we did have two pretty major genre actors pass away. And that would be Aaron Eisenberg and Sid Haig. And, you know, I wanted to kind of relate my own experiences with those two actors, from being involved with the convention scene and, attending conventions and all that kind of stuff. So, film festivals as well. I did talk about, meeting Aaron Eisenberg at the last, Star Trek Vegas. And I just wanted to kind of reiterate that he was very gracious to me. He took a picture with me. I actually bought my copy of the Deep Space Nine, What You Left Behind documentary from him. And he was gracious enough to sign a card for me that was promoting his podcast, The Seventh Rule. And he was just a really gracious person. I interacted with him numerous times on Twitter. He's one of those guys that if you tagged him on a Twitter post and said, hey, you know, something about Nog or something about him, he always was good about liking the posts, commenting. He often would comment on the hashtag All Star Trek, which is a hashtag I'm involved with that comments on live broadcasts of Star Trek episodes on the Heroes and Icons Network. And very often people would tag him and he would become part of the conversation we were having online. And so I think that's a real loss for fans. And he was a really, really good a really good guy as far as the way he treated fans. And I was curious if you had any recollections of him and all those years of conventions or anything like that, or just any other recollections of Mr. Eisenberg.
I never met him. I know that I'd always heard stories that he was really great with his fans. I saw a tremendous outpouring, you know, at his untimely, you know, passing. I mean, you know, 50s really young, you know. And it brought back some memories for me just with, you know, people who have gone too soon. But I never had the chance to meet him, unfortunately. Most of the conventions I've done, I mean, we've had Trek actors there, but I just never had the chance to meet him. But he seems like he was, you know, like you said, just a really, really gracious and really great with his fans, judging by the outpouring at his, like I said, his passing. I shared a couple different things on my Twitter, actually, like some of the most memorable scenes in any way I think of with Nog, you know, the scene on the holodeck where he's talking to, I can't remember the name of the lounge singer character, and they're having that conversation about, you know, he's talking about how he's, you know, he says, I'm as hollow as this snare drum, you know, and Nog's relating how he's feeling after, you know, what happened during the, you know, the Dominion War and the things that he saw and things he experienced in his own personal tragedy. That's a powerful scene, you know? And of course the one that started it all, where Nog basically talks about how he feels like his father's a failure and he doesn't want to be that and he wants to join Starfleet. That's another great scene, but he was a tremendous actor, an important part of Trek's history and legacy, especially when you talk about, you know, the Ferengi, like in, at least in my mind anyway. And his passing is like I said, it's just way too soon, way too soon.
Yeah, I agree. And then I do want to mention that there is a GoFundMe available for him if people are interested in supporting him. I do have it on my my Twitter. If people are interested in that, to check it out, it's not too hard to find. My own Twitter is at BaseGod14, at BASGOD14. And I do have a link to the GoFundMe that has been made for him. This is the official GoFundMe that is to benefit the family. Along with Aaron Eisenberg's passing, we also had the passing of Sid Haig. And I have a pretty good story about Sid Haig as well. Not too long ago, I went to a film festival in L.A., and this was for the premiere of the Assassin's Apprentice short film, which I was a backer on, and is... it was directed by the same director from the Occupants feature film, Russ Emanuel, who's a good friend of mine. And I went to support him and Paul Hickman, the producer and writer for that film. And Sid Haig was in attendance. He actually won an award for acting. And I wish I could remember what the name of the film was. Unfortunately, I was only at the film festival for one day, and I didn't get a chance to check out the film that he was in and that he was promoting. It was a feature film, and he got an award for it. And he did a really, really awesome acceptance speech. It was really kind of funny because apparently, even though it was a horror film, I guess he actually played a heroic character for once, because he's so well known for playing villains. And he talked about that in his acceptance speech, that it's kind of funny that for years and years he's played all these kind of degenerates, psychos, and killers. And the first time he said he played a sheriff, I think that's what his character was, a sheriff, now I get an award. And it's kind of funny, you know, because he has such a long career, and apparently that was one of the first awards he had ever gotten for acting. And so, but he related a quote about, I believe it was David Carradine, because the two of them were friends. And it was a quote from him, and I'm just going to try to paraphrase it. I'm not trying to re-quote it, but I think I can get the meaning out there. And essentially how it went was, he said, there were no failures in Hollywood, only people that give up. And I thought that was such a great message to anybody who's creative, anybody who's out there trying to be creative, trying to do creative things, whether it's writing, whether it's being an artist, even if, you know, gaming, any kind of creative endeavor, I think it applies. And it's one of those things that I think is really true. You know, you don't fail, you give up, you know, and that's what happens. And it was a really kind of inspiring speech, and people were really into it. And that wasn't too long ago. I think that was within the last year or so that I went to that event. And he looked well. You know, when I met Aaron, I met Aaron just in August, and he looked well too. So it's also one of those things to kind of keep perspective about those kinds of things. You know, things change rapidly, unfortunately. But did you have any stories about Sid Haig?
The only one I really have, I did meet Sid Haig once. When I think of Sid Haig, I think of him not so much for like the Devil's Rejects, you know, crazed killer kind of thing, but I think of him as, you know, the villain from Jason of Star Command. I think of him as, you know, being one of those villainous extras in Buck Rogers in the 25th Century, you know, and showing up in those kind of, you know, genre TV entertainment that I remember watching as a kid growing up. That's what I mostly know him from. But it was interesting. He was waiting to, I think, get a cab or something. It was at San Diego Comic-Con one year, and Lynn recognized him and was like, "Hey, it's like, would you be willing to take a picture?" And he, you know, whenever you catch a celebrity in that kind of an environment, in that kind of a setting, they're a little fearful because if they attract too much attention, whatever they were trying to do, now they can't do. You know what I mean? It's going to gather a crowd. Things are going to get out of hand. So they want to try to stay kind of incognito, but I was kind of surprised. And he was kind of nervous. You could tell he didn't kind of want to because he was worried about attracting attention. But he was like, no, come on. Let's take a picture. And he stood there and took a whole bunch of pictures, you know, not just with us, but with other people that recognized him. You know what I mean? It was really gracious and whatever, and kind of struck some poses, I guess, kind of getting in character, you know, for that, I guess the Devil Rejects thing was the thing he was most known for at that time. But no, he seemed like he was really good with the fans, and it was nice of him to, you know, take that time. And even though he was fearful to attract attention, and it did, you know, he was still kind of a good sport about it. You know what I mean? So that's kind of cool. You know, a lot of them, we've had similar experiences that were the complete opposite with other celebrities, where they would just completely shut you down and be kind of aggressive and mean, you know what I mean? And walk on, you know, they don't have to do that. The fact that he took the time and posed with some fans and took some pictures, you know what I mean? And was gracious about it. That's, for a fan, that's a big thing. You know, he wasn't getting paid to do that. He did that just because we were fans, you know, and he appreciated the fact that we were familiar with his work, you know. So it's interesting. But that's the only Sid Haig story I had. But he seemed like a really nice guy, and he kind of stood there and chatted with us a little bit, you know, and that was kind of cool. So
yeah, that's awesome. It's awesome. Wish there were more stories like that. Like you said, unfortunately, it doesn't always go that way. So another interesting news tidbit comes from the world of Star Trek Discovery. And I'm not sure if you would follow this very much, but the lawsuit that had been going on regarding an independent game developer actually from Egypt, that lawsuit has been dismissed. Are you familiar with that story?
I'm familiar with the story, and I'm familiar with the lawsuit. Just generally, I don't have a lot of specifics on it, but I am familiar about what you're bringing up. And I hadn't had a chance to get into it too much, but I did see where it looked like that it had been dismissed, but I didn't know what the specifics were.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. It's an interesting case, and it's a good one for creators to take a look at. And it's good as a fan too, if you're interested in this kind of stuff, the whole issue of intellectual property and the idea of, you know, Hollywood ripping people off and all that kind of stuff, because those accusations come up all the time. The bottom line that I think would be good for people to, especially creative people, to come away from this is there is a very high threshold. There's a very high bar to hit to prove a case like this. And that's, I think, the biggest lesson that I'm taking out of it. It's pretty interesting. because if you, myself, just looking at the basics, the similarities that he was pointing out, I thought he had a very convincing argument. But doing some research as far as the specifics of the case, and also, again, what that threshold is to actually prove a case like this, I can see why it was dismissed. There's this kind of this idea of total concepts and feel. That's the quote that I got out there, that you kind of have to prove. So it's not a matter of just getting, oh, well, these characters are very similar. You know, this concept is very similar. You kind of have to prove the whole thing is similar, you know. It's a really interesting thing. Like one article I read, it actually is from a site called plagiarismtoday.com. And they make some interesting analogies and talk about some of the different issues. But they point out, I thought this was a pretty good way to point it out, is like, for instance, you know, you can't do a Harry Potter story, but you can totally do a story about a kid who went to wizard school, you know? And I think that's one of those things where it's like, oh, obviously I'm ripping that off from Harry Potter. But that doesn't mean that the Harry Potter folks are going to be able to sue me successfully because I have a story about a kid that goes to wizard school, you know?
No, yeah, that makes sense. And that kind of follows a lot of what, you know, I've heard, you know, over the years as well. You know, it's you really, if you're going to sue someone, you do have to have a pretty open and shut case, you know, and that it's more, you know, it's weird because I guess the one thing I'm always shocked at is, as we move forward, is how different legal interpretation has changed over the years. Because if we dial back the hands of time, you know, national periodicals once upon a time successfully sued Fawcett Publications saying that Captain Marvel and Superman are essentially the same thing. And Fawcett Publications had to stop publishing Captain Marvel, their most successful character. I mean, it pretty much bankrupted the company and then eventually put national periodicals, which eventually became DC Comics, in a position where they would actually acquire Captain Marvel several years later. So it's interesting how, you know, you look at that and it's like those two characters are very different. But, you know, at that time period and when that lawsuit came out, you know, in the 40s or whatever, or might even in the 50s, when that lawsuit hit, you know, the courts went, yes, you're ripping them off. But then you turn around and you look at this ruling today and they're going, nah, maybe not. So,
yeah, it's very, very true. Yeah. So it's kind of a good case study, I guess, is what I come away with it from. It's just something for a lot of the people that are interested, especially, like I said, people that are trying to do creative things. They're trying to protect themselves and they're kind of looking at oh man, I had a really similar idea to this thing that I see now. Well, just so you know, the threshold is pretty high if you want to try to prove something like that, because it's not just quote unquote ripping you off. You've got to hit the threshold of what the laws currently say about what actual infringement is, what plagiarism actually is. So that was interesting. Also, sort of big news, I think this is something that's pretty current in the cycle as we're recording this. There was the excerpts that came out from Disney CEO Bob Iger's book regarding the deal with George Lucas. And some pretty interesting revelations came out of that, and I'm kind of surprised. Well, I'm kind of surprised that Bob Iger really admitted to some of this stuff. But at the same time, I know he wants to sell his book. It's kind of worked with me. I'm very interested in his book now, although I think from my perspective, I would have been interested in it anyway, because he obviously comes more from that, more of the corporate executive and also sort of that producer end of filmmaking. So I figure that there's probably something I can get out of that anyway. But the revelations about kind of what went down with him and George Lucas are really kind of astounding, because he essentially admits that Lucas had outlined the new trilogy films. He had three outlines, and he gave them to Bob Iger and just a handful of other people. He said there were only two other people that got copies of these, and they made the decision to buy the outlines from George Lucas, which begs the question, when exactly did this happen? Did they buy the outlines during the negotiations to buy Star Wars outright, or did they buy them afterwards? Because I think that's pretty significant in terms of what really happened, and you know, did they kind of screw George Lucas or not? Because if, you know, either way, it seems like they kind of misled George Lucas into believing that they were going to use at least some of his ideas. And the big question becomes, was this an agreement that was made during the negotiations for the acquisition of Lucasfilm, or did it happen after? Because if it happened during the negotiations, it makes you naturally think that one of the reasons George Lucas was willing to sell Star Wars was because, hey, he was under the impression that they were going to use his material and he was going to be able to finish his story. If you go the other way and they acquired these outlines after the fact, it's still kind of a crappy situation for Lucas, because they were kind of misleading him into thinking that he was still in the loop when he really wasn't.
I kind of fall in the opinion that and I haven't read the memoir. What I know about this actually comes from Robert Meyer Burnett's YouTube show, Robservations, which I quite enjoy. He was talking about that earlier today, and I had been listening to that particular episode on my lunch break and was kind of getting into it. And it's interesting because I would tend to think it probably happened while they were in negotiations to basically purchase Star Wars, because it helps Lucas to feel comfortable with the idea of like, oh, they're going to continue on. You know, it kind of helps me as a fan realize why he'd be willing to make that deal, because they're going to continue on with Star Wars and they're going to take his ideas and he gets to finish it, but he's not on the hook to pay for it if things don't work out, you know? So I kind of get that, you know, he gets to kind of go out on a win and then still finish his story. Right. But as with all things in life, nothing ever works out quite the way you expect. So there you go. So.
Yeah. Yeah. That's well said. Well said. And then I know we're going a little long on the news segment, but I did also want to mention that there was a recent article that came out, and I'm not going to say who it was. It's an online magazine, and they were upset about a video that Doomcock made regarding Brie Larson and Captain Marvel. And I just want to say I don't have a dog in this fight. I haven't even touched that or anything like that. And they didn't like what he had to say, and they made some allegations of racism and sexism, just straight up said that Doomcock was a racist and a sexist. And I just want to say, I've talked about Doomcock and his videos before, and it's not like I watch all of his content and support all of his content. I do think there are times that he steps over the line, but I also think it's important to point out that when you're having a disagreement about a character, casting choice, whatever it is, I mean, it's part of the fun of fandom is to debate about these things. When you start making personal attacks on people and you make it personal, you've crossed the line, period. I don't think that there's any place for that kind of talk, especially when you don't know the person. It doesn't contribute to the debate, and it's just not appropriate. So that's just one thing I wanted to throw out there, because it's one of those things that I want to personally fight against is, let's have the debates. Let's talk about whatever you want to talk about, whether it's casting, whether it's the merits of the character development, the quality of the story, all those kinds of things. But let's just not make it personal.
So on this episode of the Rogues Radio Podcast, what we're going to be starting off with, what we're going to be talking about, is the classic Star Trek story, City on the Edge of Forever. And I'd be asking yourself, well, Dave, why are you talking about it like that? Because what we're doing here is we're going to be looking at the story, City on the Edge of Forever, in two completely different formats. One of them being the original series episode, the one that aired on television, and the second one being the new, well, not new, I mean, it's been out for a little while, the IDW comic book series, the graphic novel that's available, Harlan Ellison's City on the Edge of Forever, based off of his original teleplay for that episode. In this first segment, we're going to be talking specifically about the classic original series episode, City on the Edge of Forever. Now, City on the Edge of Forever was season 1, episode 28 of the original series of Star Trek.
Well, I grew up watching the reruns of the original Star Trek television show as a kid. As far as my memories can go back, I remember watching this show. So I would have first saw it as a young child. Again, not first run, but in reruns. And to me, you know, the show has always been there. So, you know, my dad got me into it. He probably watched that stuff first run when it first came out. So it's been in my memory pretty much as far as my memory goes back.
So, yeah, and I'd say that's kind of the same for me. I mean, Trek has always been there. I often tell the story about how the thing that inspired me to start drawing is because I saw my mom actually doing a watercolor painting of Spock, and that inspired me to want to do what she was doing. So Trek is a really important thing for me. Top 10 episodes of Star Trek. I remember years ago, I think it was around one of the anniversaries, I think it might have been the 25th anniversary, they did, you know, the best 10 episodes of original series, the best 10 episodes of Next Gen. And if I remember correctly, City on the Edge of Forever was number one. So it's obviously a very popular episode, and it's a great episode. I mean, it's quintessential Trek. To me, it's the one I think that comes closest. You know, when people talk about their favorite Star Trek, a lot of people talk about Star Trek IV, you know, The Voyage Home. And to me, City on the Edge of Forever is kind of in that same sort of level when you talk about classic Trek. Would you feel the same way?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's well deserved that it comes up on the top of almost every Star Trek list. I don't know if I think it's the best Star Trek ever. I mean, I kind of have to think about that a little bit more. But it's an absolutely classic episode. I remember I was always kind of a history buff as a kid. Still am to this day, and it's one of the things I really appreciated about the show, the episode, was the sort of irony of it, that this person, Joan Collins' character in particular, that she was someone who was an advocate for peace and very much a forward-thinking person, very much in a lot of ways like Gene Roddenberry himself. And it was kind of interesting because the hook of the episode, of course, is that even though she's this far-thinking person and she's ultimately right, her thinking wasn't right for the time that she was living in.
Right. And it's interesting, too, because I don't really consider myself a history buff per se, but I do enjoy revisiting. What's interesting about this radio drama is that it's set kind of as the backdrop for World War II. And there's this similar kind of thing going on about whether, and it's an important part of this the show, is whether or not, you know, America should or should not be involved in the war, because this is obviously before the bombing at Pearl Harbor. And it's just very interesting. When I revisit City on the Edge of Forever, I always think about that and what it must have been. You know what I mean? It's such an interesting time. And of course, in the episode, the role that Edith Keeler plays as being a peace, in a weird way, how that unfortunately could cause things to turn out so drastically different.
Oh yeah, yeah. It really makes you think, actually. And of course, for anybody that's not aware of that, as far as the history goes, there was a huge anti-war movement prior to World War II in the United States. It was actually led by Charles Lindbergh, of all people, who was highly, highly, highly esteemed at the time. And people listened to him. And there was a huge movement to keep the United States out of the war. It was a constant point of aggravation, actually, for the president at the time, for Franklin Roosevelt. So in a lot of ways, the whole idea is actually very plausible with the right kind of articulation and a combination maybe of some politics there. The United States may not have entered World War II, certainly when it did.
One of the things interesting about Sand Edge Forever, talking about, you know, more than just the episode itself, but maybe a little bit behind the scenes things, is I know from reading Starlog magazine that apparently Harlan Ellison and Gene Roddenberry had some obvious friction and disagreements over City on the Edge of Forever. Now, I didn't realize just how radically different Harlan Ellison's original teleplay, you know, or script that he turned in for the story actually was. And I never really had too much of an opinion about whether or not Harlan Ellison was right or Gene Roddenberry was right. But I do remember hearing a lot about the controversy and the friction between the two gentlemen, because I know that having listened to a lot of, well, there's a, I'm trying to remember the name of it, but I think it's like, there's a series of books that's sort of like an oral history of Star Trek, like in a, you know, they take all these different things and compile it together. And there's, if I remember correctly, I think it's the first 50 years and second, or the next 50 years or whatever it is. And they start with the original series Trek and take it all the way through Next Gen and everything. And I actually got it as an audio book off Audible and had listened to it. And I know there's a lot of people complaining about Gene doing rewrites on their scripts. So I know it was an issue. Do you ever remember hearing anything about the controversy between Harlan Ellison and Gene Roddenberry and him rewriting City on the Edge of Forever?
Yes, I do remember hearing about that, although I'm not quite sure where it is I heard it. I did read Starlog magazine growing up, ironically, usually just at the newsstand. I rarely actually bought the issues and took them home. But I would often sit at one of those racks. I would take it out and I would read articles. So I don't know if that's how I heard about the controversy. I'm aware that there was a book that Harlan Ellison was involved with where it had not just the original version, but my understanding is it had like four different versions of the script, you know? And it sort of tried to kind of really show what all the differences were. And in doing research for this episode, I found out that the whole argument actually got really nasty at various times between Gene and Ellison, where there were just kind of accusations back and forth about the level of their competence and who was really messing things up and all that kind of stuff. So I don't know exactly where it is that I first heard about it, but I was aware of it from a fairly young age, probably at least in my teenage years. I'm not sure where I actually got the whiffs of it, but I didn't realize until researching this episode just how bad it got.
So we're obviously going to be talking about the Harlan Ellison City on the Edge of Forever, but I think we definitely both agree that if you've never seen the classic Star Trek episode City on the Edge of Forever from the original series, people should definitely check it out, don't you think?
Yes, although it's hard to imagine anybody that hasn't seen it.
I know, but you never know. There's probably some people who haven't. But
right.
Obviously, you know, before we move into the next segment, you know, if you haven't seen City on the Edge of Forever, I know I definitely speak for myself. I highly recommend that, you know, if you can watch it through Netflix, you can watch it through the CBS All Access. I think you can also watch it actually through Amazon Prime. There's a bunch of different ways you can watch it. But it's definitely, this is one of the classic Star Trek episodes. Like I said, it usually is on everyone's top 10 list. Where it sits on the list is a matter of preference, but it's definitely one of the better of the original series episodes, in my opinion.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, even I remember TV Guide putting it on one of their lists. I think that was like of all time, you know,
shows ever.
So in this segment, we're going to be talking about the IDW adaptation that they did in comic book or graphic novel form, depending upon, you know, how you like to look at these things. I say that because some people feel like if it's a graphic novel, it's more important than if it's a comic book. To me, it's all the same thing. It's sequential storytelling. It's a great thing, kids. If you're not reading comics, you should be. All right, so we're talking about... this is the IDW Harlan Ellison's City on the Edge of Forever, based off of the original teleplay. This originally came out in 2014. I only recently became available, not available, or aware of it because it was being recommended actually on Comixology Unlimited, which is where I read it. I do have a Comixology Unlimited account, and I read comics on there pretty regularly, and I find it to be a very worthwhile investment. Now, this, of course, is based off of Harlan Ellison's original teleplay for City on the Edge of Forever. This adaptation is by Yutsutaki. I'm sure I pronounced his name incorrectly. I apologize for that right now. And the editor on this is Chris Royale, who I believe is also the publisher over at IDW.
A couple months ago, I think it was.
Tell me, Eric, how did you first hear about this adaptation of Harlan Ellison's original teleplay of City on the Edge of Forever?
That this had been done. I mentioned in the earlier segment, I was aware of a book. I remember seeing it in the bookstore. In fact, I think it might still be in print. It's been a while, actually, since I've actually been in a bookstore. But I was aware that there was this book that had come out where there are various versions of the script. And I believe that there's actually quite a bit of commentary from Ellison in that book. I've never actually read it. I do remember kind of leafing through it one time. But I had no idea about this comic adaptation until you told me about it.
So here's the thing we want to do right off the bat. Kind of like with Dark Crystal, I think what we should do is we should just talk about how we feel about this series in generalities, avoid spoilers, and then we're going to give you all a spoiler warning, and we're just going to go just Star Trek fan. You should definitely check this out because it's interesting to see how radically different City on the Edge of Forever could have been, one. Number two... I was pleasantly surprised by the art by J.K. Woodward. I mean, I'm familiar with J.K. Woodward's art, just, you know, kind of in passing and different people recommending things to me here and there. But I thought the art in this series was actually quite good. I was pleasantly surprised. I didn't expect it to be bad, you know, but it just had a higher caliber of execution than for some reason in my mind I thought we were going to be getting. The other thing that I found really interesting about it, which just a little bit more commentary in the art, if you like Alex Ross's painterly style, this is kind of a similar kind of thing. First cover is the most striking. The other covers are good, but the cover is the only thing that left me a little cold. I liked the first one, but then the other ones I felt like I would have rather seen J.K. Woodward, who's the interior artist actually, and the sequential storyteller for this, actually come on and actually do the covers. I think it would have represented the story a little bit stronger. That's just my personal opinion. I always feel like the interior artist should always do their own covers. That's just my own personal bias. Now, and I would say overall for me, I would say this is a recommend, especially if you're a Star Trek fan.
Well, I think the most striking thing for me actually is the art style. I thought it was really good. I think the thing that to me is it doesn't look like your average comic book, I guess is the way to put it. It has, I think you mentioned, sort of more of that like a painted feel to it. That even though it's not on the level of Alex Ross in terms of like photorealistic, but it's definitely kind of in that direction. And I definitely enjoyed the artwork and think it's kind of it's striking to me in a good way. I do think that there's no doubt that it has historical value for any hardcore Star Trek fan. And even for a more casual fan, if you are a fan of that particular episode of The City on the Edge of Forever, if you acknowledge it as the classic that it is, I think that you would have an interest in this comic book. Because it definitely has historic value. as a fan.
Cool, cool. So now we're going to go into spoiler talk, and I think this is what I've been waiting to get into, because the reason I started pitching this for the show when we first started doing them is because I knew you were a big Star Trek fan, and I was, again, this is spoiler talk, everyone, you've been warned. I was completely shocked by how this thing starts. Were you shocked by how this thing started?
Not exactly. The big thing that I always heard with all the different exchanges that I heard over the years about Ellison's version versus the version we actually saw on screen was this idea of the drug dealer. And I actually didn't realize it was a drug dealer. I think the way that I had heard it was a drug addict. Okay. And we have both in this version. There's a drug addict and a drug dealer. I think the way that I had heard it was that McCoy's character was supposed to be a drug addict. And actually, he's the dealer, right? So that part was a little bit shocking to me. But I'd always heard the drug situation being a big part of what this originally was and also part of the conflict. So I wasn't completely shocked, but I was surprised to realize McCoy's part was not a drug user. He was the drug dealer.
Right. And here's the other thing. I was shocked at the whole drug one, the drug dealer, you know, guy essentially, you know, extorting stuff out of the person who was obviously the addict, and he was having him like snatch things for him, like on away missions and stuff, right? That he was in turn selling on the black market or whatever. It was just a crazy idea that you would have, you know, a member of Starfleet, you know, an officer, no less, you know what I mean? Who was that sort of, I don't want to call him evil, but just sort of, well, I guess he is kind of evil. Spock even calls him evil, that someone would be that questionable character, but then actually a Starfleet officer, right?
Yeah, I mean, he is evil. I mean, like I said, it, you know, but my original understanding was that this was an addict, and maybe you could feel some kind of sympathy for him or something like that. No, this is a dealer, and like you said, not only is he a dealer, not only does he deal death, okay, he has been exploiting other civilizations, as you mentioned, and that kind of stuff was shocking to me. I was like, you know, I had to do some research because I was so kind of off put by that. You know, the research, of course, said that the original teleplay was made before they really kind of established the characters in Star Trek and the world. In fact, this was actually produced prior to Gene Roddenberry actually writing a Bible for Star Trek.
And you can see that. You can tell, especially as you get further into this particular story, you know, when Kirk starts talking about, for example, like towards the end of this series, where he's lamenting the fact that he is going to be leaving Edith Keeler behind, you know, and the connection that he's made with her and how special it is to him. And he talks about how as an early age that, you know, he was serving on board, which sounds like old style rocket ships, you know, and you see the way that Spock is trying to relate to him. And you can tell by the things that Spock is saying that they haven't figured Spock hardly out at all either, you know, but visually, you know, because the art is so good, you're still seeing them as the classic representations that you remember from City on the Edge of Forever. But then the things they're saying, you're like, what? It's like, that's the thing I found most interesting about this, because this is one of the things I love about the old Gold Key Star Trek comics, is the fact they haven't quite figured things out yet. And I enjoy seeing Star Trek in a completely different light. You know, they beam down to a planet and they've got canteens and shovels and like all this other stuff. It's like, why are they carrying all this gear out in backpacks and, you know, tricorders or communicators, you know? And it's kind of fun, you know? But the thing that was weird about this one is it's the words coming out of their mouth that there's this huge disconnect. But visually, the rest of it kind of makes sense, you know. But the way that the things that they're saying, the things they're doing, does it, you know, there's a huge, you know, shift from what I guess visually we know to be Trek, but then the situations and the things they're saying. So one of the other things I found particularly interesting and really kind of cool about this one is that the city on the edge of forever is like a whole huge abandoned city. And I quite liked the depiction of it. What did you think about the design and the depiction of literally the city on the edge of forever?
It's very different, obviously, from what we saw on the show. You know, it's hard to say because, as I mentioned before, I grew up on the show, and I can't even tell you when I first saw City on the Edge of Forever because I was so young, and it just goes back as far as my memories go. This depiction of the city, and as you said, being an actual real city, it's interesting. It's one of those things, though, where, you know, coming from the background of being someone who is involved with film production, I'm like, Ellison had to have known there was no way they were going to do this.
Yeah, you would think so.
There was no way they had the budget for it. So that's kind of glaring to me, and that's the producer talking, because I already have these issues when I'm dealing with people that are writing with me, or writing, you know, for me, if you will. I have these issues with my partner when he comes up with ideas, and I have to tell him there's no way we could do that. You know, there's just no way we could do that. Yeah, well, I'm not sure if I was shocked about that, because obviously I knew from the outset that his role was going to be played by somebody else. That's the big thing I knew from sort of an early age and at Herd, in terms of the differences between the original teleplay and what was shot. So I guess I wasn't too terribly shocked that McCoy doesn't have a substantial role, because I knew his role was taken over, or, you know, was originally intended for a different character.
The one of the things that was interesting too is that, you know, what we think of as the Guardian, you know, is actually kind of more like the Guardians, because there's all these different representations. I forget how many of them there are, but there's all these different kind of, you know, sort of characters that kind of represent the Guardian, and it's just so radically different. Now here's the other thing I found completely shocking as you get into it. Were you also stunned that Dr. McCoy is not even in this? I was kind of shocked. I mean, I thought that he would play some kind of a role, because it was weird because Yeoman Rand has a bigger role in this, you know, than McCoy. And then I thought it was weird too that they're expecting, and it kind of shows how they hadn't quite figured it all out yet, that they were expecting Yeoman Rand with a group of security officers to supposedly kind of hold down the fort. And I was like, well, that just sounds crazy to me. Did you find Yeoman Rand's role in this to be a little, I don't know, surprising?
A little bit. I did notice the scene, and there's even somebody that talks about it in the letters section in the back of the book. I did read some of that, some of the letter sections, and especially the ones where Harlan himself actually responded, you know, because I think that's also interesting, and that's also why I say this is kind of a neat historical record, you know, even if you don't end up liking this version, it's kind of neat in that regard. And I noticed somebody kind of called out what I was thinking too, which was that there's when they get beamed up to the ship, which they think is, you know, the Enterprise, and it turns out it's some sort of weird pirate ship or something like that, right? It's Yeoman Rand who actually does something to the transporter controls that allows them to get the advantage over these rogues, these pirates, and get them out of the transporter room, because they've already taken the security detail. They've already captured them. And so they go up in waves. You know, the security guys go up first, and then Kirk, Spock, and the Yeoman Rand, they go up second. And she does something to create a distraction or whatever, so they're able to overpower these guys and throw them out. So I thought that was interesting because that's definitely a more active role than what we really saw her do in the series. And I did find that interesting. But also, you know, I did do research as I was reading this, and I realized that she was still a part of the series when he originally wrote this.
Right. Because Yeoman Rand was supposed to have kind of a larger role, and for whatever reason, it just never seemed to really coalesce, I think, in the way that anyone originally intended, you know, for her character anyway. But I was just kind of shocked to see her taking such an active role, you know, in so many different moments, because, you know, technically as a yeoman, I mean, she isn't, like, she's not even an ensign, you know what I mean? So I just was kind of shocked at some of it. It was a little weird, but I like that. That's one of the things I like about this. It's so different. Trying to think. I think we kind of covered the main beats. So at the end, well, in our next segment, I think we'll get into it. We'll get a little bit further into it, and we'll kind of compare and contrast and kind of compare the television episode probably a little bit more specifically to the adaptation. So we're talking about City on the Edge of Forever. We're talking about, obviously, the original series episode, as well as the IDW published adaptation of Harlan Ellison's original teleplay for the same episode. So obviously, I'm going to go ahead and come down and say that while I quite enjoyed the Harlan Ellison teleplay as an interesting I guess we'll call it piece of history when you want to look at the difference in terms of interpretation, like what Harlan Ellison thought would make a good episode versus obviously, you know, what Gene Roddenberry rewrote and turned into The City on the Edge of Forever. I quite prefer the original series episode. There's some things about the adaptation I found a little, while interesting and makes sense, there's just some things about the Harlan Ellison that didn't quite make sense for me. Like the fact that, you know, Beckwith, the drug dealer, the evil drug dealer, for example, is going to try and save Edith Keeler. That felt like that came out of left field. And that's the thing I think that for me was just kind of the most kind of head scratching, despite all the other kind of differences. The idea that Spock apparently was prepared to kill Edith Keeler to, you know, reestablish the timeline. I found that was a little shocking and weird. But as an interesting thing to have on a bookshelf, as an interesting exploration of a different take on Trek, in a weird way, it reminds me of the Gold Key comics, because a lot of those early Gold Key comics, they're still figuring it out. And I used to always say, you know, this is the next installment of the ISS Enterprise Adventures, you know what I mean, as opposed to the USS Enterprise Adventures. This kind of reminded me of the same thing. It was kind of the same weird, you know what I mean, you could always imagine this is the Mirror Universe versions of these characters, you know, this is what they were experiencing, you know, with the drug dealer on board the ship and everything else, and the fact Yeoman Round's running around with a gun, you know, taking care of business, you know, it fits more the ISS Enterprise Adventures. But that's my own personal taste. Tell me, Eric, which do you prefer between the original series episode and this adaptation?
Well, like I don't think there's a huge contest between the two of them. I mean, I prefer the televised version. Just because it's consistent with Gene's vision. This story is not. The whole idea of a drug dealer, first of all, the idea of a drug addict, it just doesn't work for me to begin with. But the idea that this drug dealer, this horrible drug dealer that is exploiting other cultures while he's running around on the Enterprise, it makes me think, you know, what was Harlan really thinking? did he just not get it? Did Gene not explain early on what his vision was? Because, I mean, I can see it in the pilot. I can see it in both pilots, regardless of whether he had written the Bible by that time or not. And it's very jarring. It's funny what you said about the mirror universe, though, because one thing that I did see was, because I thought the scene was mostly unnecessary for them to go back to the Enterprise, with the sort of pirate rogue version. That's the way I'm calling it. But in a lot of ways, it kind of did remind me of the mirror universe. And I thought that maybe, just maybe, that kind of creeped in a little bit to when they did do the mirror universe, that they had that institutional memory of the original teleplay. And this idea of a sort of warped Enterprise, because it's unclear whether it's the same ship or not. But obviously there is a ship that's in orbit that they go to, thinking it's the Enterprise. It turns out to be these sort of pirates, these sort of rogues. So I kind of wonder if that was the genesis of the Mirror Universe, which Mirror Mirror is actually one of my favorite Star Trek episodes of all time. And so I do wonder if that put the kernel of that idea, because I think it's a totally unnecessary scene in the story. Honestly, I don't see much reason for it to be there. Other than my understanding was at some point, Gene, mentioned that he would like to see what's going on with the ship, to show some sort of peril with the ship. I did find that in my research, but it's just, to me, it seems like a very unnecessary scene, but I wonder if it was kind of the genesis of the mirror universe. In regards to some of the other things, the ending, like you mentioned, I actually thought that was kind of poignant in a way, because what they were trying to say was that humanity is kind of worth something because even the worst of us is capable of compassion. I thought that was kind of an interesting idea, an interesting theme. But I actually kind of look at things the other way around in terms of, I believe that even good people are capable of heinous evil. But I thought it was an interesting theme. It was an interesting idea. I don't know how much it works, for the story, but I do think it was an interesting theme. And it was an interesting way to go, because they do have this dynamic where Spock is even more dismissive of humans in this version than he is in the series. I mean, he calls humans barbarians and things like that. So that was interesting to me.
I want to thank you for listening to this episode of the Rogues Radio Podcast. Again, my name is Dave Beatty, and I've been one of your hosts. I want to encourage you, if you're interested, to learn more about me, see some of my artworks, learn more about what I normally do. Definitely check out my website at davebeatty.com. That's www.davebeatty.com. Also, this coming weekend, September 28th and the 29th, noon to noon, I will be participating in the 24-hour Comic Book Day Challenge. This is being put on by several different groups, one of them being the Northern Arizona Cartoonists Association, or NASCA, as well as the Clarkdale Downtown Business Alliance and the Clarkdale Foundation. This is a fundraiser for the Clark Memorial Library, but six artists, 24 hours, no sleep. I know the tagline here says no problem, but of course there'll be problems. But it'll be happening at 921 Main Street in Clarkdale, the future home of the Park Hotel. Definitely consider, if you're in the area, coming down, checking out what we're doing. Watch us attempt to create a comic book in 24 hours. It's always kind of fun and kind of weird. So definitely check that out. I want to thank Eric Alexander for coming aboard yet again for another great episode of the Rogues Radio Podcast. Thank you, Eric, for being on the show. Please tell the people where to learn more about you on the interwebs.
I'm most active on Twitter, and you can find me on Twitter at BaseGod14. That's at BASSGOD14. I also want to mention that I have started doing a supplement YouTube video for this show, with my intention being to sort of go over certain things that we went over in the show, maybe expand a little bit on things that I felt we didn't touch on enough. And then also I try to put in some contemporary news that maybe we didn't have in the show because of when we recorded it. So it's kind of something to kind of fill in between to our next show. So, and that is also BassGod14, BassGod14 on YouTube. And also please keep in mind Bad Bob Productions, which is my film production company in Arizona.